Good morning. The remote hearing of the Capital Investment and Climate and Energy Finance and Policy Committees for January 29th is called to order.
So this remote hearing is taking place in accordance to House Rule 10.01 is being live streamed by House Public Information Office. Members and for testifiers, remember, as custom, all discussion will be through the two chairs. And a reminder for members to please remain having decorum to treat everyone with respect, fairness, and courtesy. And now I'll turn it over to Chair Long.
Thank you so much, Chair Lee. I'm really excited for this joint hearing that we're having together. And thank you so much for your collaboration and leadership and organizing it. We, I think, are going to hear some really interesting and timely testimony from Minnesota climate experts on what the data shows about the risk of climate change and how to respond to it by investing in our infrastructure to build a more sustainable and more resilient infrastructure for our state. So I'm pleased to be here and pleased that many of our committee members could be coming together for this conversation.
Thank you, Chair Long. And this for the Capital Investment Committee member, this will be the first of three hearings on how to respond to climate's impact on infrastructure to position us for a better future. I'm so pleased that we are able to bring our two committees together today to receive this information. And we'll get started with former Representative Dr. Kate Knuth. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and chairs and members. I'm Dr. Kate Knuth, and I'm working with the National Caucus of Environmental Legislators on some climate policy consulting. And I'm really excited that you all are coming together today to talk about the intersections between climate change and capital investment, because in many ways, climate change is an infrastructure challenge. And you're the infrastructure committee and the climate committee coming together. And the choices we make today in the state capital investment bill will be with us until the year 2050. And 2050 is the year the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has shown the world needs to be at carbon neutrality, basically having carbon at zero. And we need a 45% reduction by 2030. And these are the goals that the Minnesota Climate Action Plan has put forward as well based on the science of the IPCC. And so I'm going to give you just a little bit of an introduction, and then the sort of meat of the testimony will be with the next testifiers. But overall, to think about climate change and capital investment, we need to think we're getting warmer and wetter. But even more, we're getting riskier with a changing climate. So for example, 65% increase in 3-inch rains in the last century. Large area mega rains are 4 times more common after 2000 than the previous 30 years before 2000. That's data from the Minnesota Environmental Quality Board. And those, you know, if you've served in the legislature for a few years, those large area mega rains are like what happened in Duluth in 2012, or like what happened in Rushford in 2007. So there's really two big buckets of how to deal with the increasing risk of climate change, and both matter for how we think about capital investment. And you're going to learn about both today and in the hearings next week. So first, we need to stop making the problem worse. We need to reduce emissions across sectors quickly. You're going to be getting a report on overall Minnesota emissions today, hot off the presses report just a few weeks ago. And honestly, the news isn't great, but the good news is that in the electricity sector, where Minnesota has had the most focused policy work, that's where we're actually seeing emissions reductions. And so I think one of the things we can learn is if we do take a focus of policy making on reducing emissions in a sector, we can make progress. And so we need to expand that across sectors of transportation and agriculture and the built environment. You're also going to be hearing about two big potential capital investment opportunities for reducing emissions today in the transportation sector, and then multifamily and affordable housing. Government buildings is another great example as you're thinking about the sort of arc of your decision making as policymakers. Second, in addition to not making the problem even worse, we need to make sure we're proactively addressing the risks of climate change. And we already see these things happening with the data I talked about with big rain events, and we know more are coming. These are already really baked in to some extent, and there'll be smaller impacts if we make more emissions reductions. So in some of the response to this kind of risk is called adaptation and resilience policy. You're going to be hearing from Drs. Hellman and Roop from the University of Minnesota, and they're going to give you kind of an overview about thinking about risk at the intersection of climate change and infrastructure and capital investment. And they're going to give you some specific examples and understanding vulnerabilities and smart infrastructure responses to deal with the impacts of climate change and adapt. And then as you think about what you're learning today in the hearings, and what you learned, I think, and I wasn't able to see all these hearings, but I know you had hearings about equity as well in capital investment. Really similar things apply with climate change. For example, urban heat islands in the city of Minneapolis, there's really interesting and a little bit disturbing research that comes out that neighborhoods that were redlined, where there's higher numbers of Black and brown Minnesotans and where there's lower wealth and where there's been, frankly, underinvestment by the public sector, these neighborhoods in Minneapolis can be up to 10 degrees hotter on the hottest summer days. And that has really important health and equity effects. So the intersection of capital investment and climate change, risk mitigation and reduction, and equity are really key things to be considering as a committee. But really, I want to end with the fact that this hearing and approach is really, it gives me hope. We are in a moment where we have a huge opportunity to make a more climate safe, resilient Minnesota. And the things that we build, the like stuff of our state that we build together with bonding dollars and with capital investments, those are essential to help us build the kind of climate safe, resilient state we know we can have and we deserve. Thank you, chairs and members.
Thank you so much, Dr. Knuth. Just to mention, we're going to be holding questions until the end of our presentation. So we'll be moving to next Dr. Hellman and Dr. Roop, who I understand we'll be presenting together. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Chair Lee, Chair Long, and members of the Capital Investment and Climate and Energy and Policy Committees, thank you for this opportunity. I am Dr. Heidi Roop, an assistant professor of climate science in the Department of Soil, Water, and Climate at the University of Minnesota. I also serve as the state's new extension specialist for climate science. I also have the privilege of serving as the university's co-lead of the Minnesota Climate Adaptation Partnership, the state's only multi-sector statewide group working on climate adaptation, the preparing for climate change. We have members from state agencies, the private sector, nonprofits, city and state governments, and higher education. I'm joined today by my colleague, Dr. Jessica Hellman, who serves as the director of the Institute on the Environment and is a professor of ecology, evolution, and behavior. She will be presenting the latter part of our remarks today. Both Dr. Hellman and I work on climate issues and various aspects of climate science and climate preparedness, and we are grateful for this opportunity to share our expertise with you today on this important topic for our state's infrastructure, and our capital investment. I'm new to the state of Minnesota. I'm really glad to be here, and this is my first opportunity to testify. I look forward to the conversation and working together in the future. Before I go into my presentation, I just want to be clear that managing Minnesota's climate risks is not a new need. Minnesota's known for its iconic weather and its extremes, from frigid winters to humid, sun-soaked summers. However, the baseline of our climate is shifting to one that is warmer and wetter. The impacts of these changes require us to have a new understanding of our climate risks, as the past is no longer the most accurate predictor of the future. To be concrete, looking in the rearview mirror to our past climate risks, like flood volume and frequency, no longer gives us a full and complete picture about our future climate risks. With climate change, using slowly the rearview mirror means we're likely going to miss the curve in the road ahead. This, of course, changes how we need to plan, how we need to think, and how we need to invest. Managing our exposure to these increasing climate risks requires both an understanding of these new risks and innovative, creative, and practical thinking about how we manage our exposure to these changes. Next slide, please. Without stealing too much of my thunder and my subsequent remarks, we're already seeing Minnesota's climate change and an amplification of the events that tend to stress or challenge our ability to effectively maintain and provide the same level of service with our infrastructure, among a wide range of other impacts. Events like floods, extreme heat, and warming lake waters are all climate risks with tangible impacts to our communities, our environment, and our economy. Effectively managing for these risks can lead to what we call resiliency, This is essentially how well, say, a building in a floodplain will be able to withstand to future flooding and how quickly that asset can recover from any damage that might occur during a given flood event. I'll be providing a few examples of both observed and projected climate data for Minnesota in my subsequent slides, but some of the central points are here on this slide. Impacts on our assets are already happening. Our ability to anticipate and prepare for these impacts will increase with our ability to withstand and recover from these impacts. And we have an opportunity now to consider how we shift our stance from one that is reactive climate risk management to one that's predominantly proactive, taking the information on board that we have as we look no longer in the rearview mirror, but in front of us. Dr. Hellman will touch on this in more detail with more specifics in her portion of our remarks, including examples of exemplary work already underway here in Minnesota and across the nation. Next slide, please. Importantly, change is here. Average global temperature has increased by over 2 degrees Fahrenheit since the late 1800s. For context, the targets set by the Paris Climate Agreement are for pursuing efforts to limit this temperature increase to 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit or 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. We're already most of the way there. However, these changes are not just global. Next slide, please. Change is also here in our backyard. In Minnesota, we're lucky to be able to draw on climate observations back to the late 1800s. These are managed by Minnesota State's Department of Natural Resources State Climatology Office. These data help us quantify how today is different from our past. Minnesota's average annual temperature has increased by nearly 3 degrees Fahrenheit since 1895. This is already influencing the things we care about and rely on every day, from our roads and rivers to our lakes and stormwater infrastructure and our health. Next slide. But what does this really mean? While this presentation will not provide you with an exhaustive list of the range of climate impacts that we're experiencing or anticipate experiencing here in Minnesota, we've identified what we think are two impacts that are most salient for you and your work and that represent well the challenge and complexity for effective climate risk management when it comes to capital investment. In Minnesota, both changing temperature and changing precipitation patterns are central chapters in our climate story. Next slide, please. As I already said, Minnesota is warming, but that warming is not equally distributed across the state or over the year. These plots show you this. We're looking on the left at average annual temperature change measured across our state between 1895 and 2019. You can see there's a strong north-south gradient in this warming, and there's seasonal variability. The middle slide, the bright orange that's probably standing out to you on this slide, shows us changes in our winter low temperatures. What used to be extremely cold just hasn't been occurring. In fact, I was on the phone last night with Dr. Mark Seeley, who's about next week to, I think, put a blog out about a record minus 60 degree Fahrenheit day that occurred in Minnesota and is marking its 25th anniversary next week. The point here is that these cold or low temperatures are occurring less frequently. And according to the State Climatology Office, quote, what used to be considered extremely cold no longer occurs. Next slide. We also have clear evidence of changing patterns in precipitation, and this is potentially, this is a very critical point to consider. We've already seen a dramatic shift in warmer and wetter conditions over the past several decades. We've documented a change in the frequency and the amount that's occurring in heavy downpours, and this has consequences for the things that we care about and the things that we manage. Next slide, please. In fact, we can look at this warmth and this wetness. This is these data are from the State Climatology Office. This plot is showing you the temperature change from the 20th century average on the x-axis and the 20th century average change in annual precipitation on the y-axis. In the upper right quadrant, where I've put a red box and where you see red dots that are annotated, we can see that this quadrant represents those years that are both above average in wetness and above average in warmth. We can see, when we look at the years when these events occurred in this upper right quadrant, that the 10 combined wettest and warmest years on record have all occurred after 1997. I'll note here, because this is an important point, that But as with any of these observed trends or projected changes, typical ups and downs will always be superimposed over our changing trend towards warmer, wetter conditions. That is to say, we'll still experience dry seasons or years within decades that are predominantly wet. Floods will interrupt what are sustained periods of drought. Cold extremes will occur during what are warm winters. Just as there are years shown on this plot that were warm or wet or wet and cold, we can see from data like these that it's our baseline that's shifting, and that's what's concerning. Another great example of this is last year, 2020, in the Fort Ridgely area, they're in and are continuing to sort of head into what we would call drought conditions. But in that same sort of overall pattern of drought, it was interrupted with two storm events, one of which was a 200-year event and another which was a 500-year event. Essentially, these trends and the current variability point in the direction of what we expect changing climate extremes to both feel and look like. Next slide, please. This increasing precipitation and these changing patterns and the shift to warmer, wetter conditions elevates our regional flood risk across the Midwest. This is produced and published and assessed by the National Climate Assessment. And this importantly translates to damage to the things that we care about and the infrastructure that we manage. Next slide. Critically, not only are we seeing these changes occur and are we elevating our risks, but we can see that there are costs that we're incurring today as a consequence of these changes. In fact, 2020 was a record year according to NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information, who track billion-dollar disasters amongst a variety of other climate variables and data about the impacts of a changing climate. These events, these billion-dollar events can span things from flooding and wildfires to hurricanes. 2020 was actually tied for the warmest year on record. We had $22 billion disasters in 1 year, resulting in a combined $95 billion in damages. And many of these billion-dollar disasters that are occurring will become more frequent or more numerous. Next slide. In fact, here in Minnesota, some events that could lead to significant damages, we're seeing already seeing observations and have future projections that indicate these events, like very heavy precipitation, which increase our flood risk, are more likely to increase. We therefore expect the risks from floods to increase. Next slide, please. And as these risks increase, so do the costs. Climate projections by the end suggest that by the end of the century, both our winter and our springtime precipitation could increase by up to 30%. For us, this is important. That seasonality of the changing precipitation pattern is important because this happens to be when we also experience and increase our risk for flood and have damages. So the fourth National Climate Assessment and references therein suggested that this changing seasonality and increase in precipitation in winter and spring could translate to $500 million in annual damages from floods across the Midwest alone. This is in 2015 dollars. Next slide, please. And I started with warming. And warming, of course, comes with its impacts. So we're focusing today primarily on precipitation and warming. We expect our minimum winter temperatures to be nearly 10 degrees Fahrenheit warmer by mid to late century relative to the 1981 to 2010 average. Next slide, please. If we look to the future and to summer months, we're actually expected to see many more days that we classify as being very hot. Those are days with temperatures in excess of 95 degrees Fahrenheit. We're expecting this change to emerge on the time on our horizons by mid-century. And for mid-century in this context, that means the 2040s to 2070s. Next slide, please. And of course, with heat, it's not just the fact that it's warming or that we will experience more of these extremes, is that there are impacts. This extreme heat can stress our infrastructure, our social systems, our health, and our environment. In regards to infrastructure, extreme heat creates material stresses on roads, buildings, bridges, our water infrastructure, and our railroads. I work with water utilities across the nation who are already grappling with these challenges. They're already these associated with heat and, of course, those associated with flooding. Trends in our region show that these extremes haven't yet shown up, but all model projections indicate that this extreme heat and these changes aren't far away. We have an opportunity to prepare. Next slide. And if we look towards the future costs of these changes, the EPA estimates that temperature will translate into real costs if we do not limit the amount of warmth that the planet, the amount that we warm our planet. This is in excess of billions of dollars. The EPA estimates that higher temperatures will have significant costs both for our region and our country. It is important to note here, however, while we do expect, say, added costs for annual road maintenance or for rail transportation, we do expect some of those trends that I talked about in terms of our warming winters to potentially partially offset some of these damages in our region, because that mild warming actually reduces things like rutting that are the consequence of intense freeze-thaw cycles. This is to say it's expensive, and of course, we can't just think about infrastructure. We have to think about the people who maintain and keep that infrastructure running. The EPA estimates $33 billion annually in losses in labor and associated economic revenue just associated with heat alone. They also point out that there are savings from proactive adaptation, using roads as an example to continue the thread here. Across all road types and all climate stressors, being proactive in our adaptation and management of our road assets and to protect against climate change means we can decrease, they've estimated that we can decrease our costs over the century, so by the end of the century, by 98%. And this is under high emissions. So if we act to prepare and prevent the impacts of high emissions, there are significant cost savings. The same report, which I'm happy to share with your offices, also outlines the costs and savings across different sectors, from everything from human health to the costs of air pollution. Next slide. The National Climate Assessment also points out that our region is particularly vulnerable. The Midwest is among the regions with the largest expected damages to infrastructure, including the highest estimated damages to roads. Our roads, of course, are a lifeline for our communities and economies and are connected to a wide range of other capital investment. Next slide, please. Of course, these extremes are costly, both today and in the future. These are costs that are financial, social, environmental. There are costs in both directions, both action and inaction. And the climate science will never tell you exactly what will happen on a given day, in a given season, in a given year. Just as your population model will never tell you precisely how many people will be drawing on a given water supply. But what we can tell you with high confidence is that the changes are coming, many of them are already here, and they're both associated with both increasing risks and increasing costs. The challenge now is to meaningfully integrate and incorporate these risks in our decision-making, including how we incorporate this knowledge in our capital investment. Next slide, please. There is good news. We have data, we have information, and are working on generating even better climate, environmental, and exposure risk data and cost data and mitigation and adaptation options and technologies that can inform and advance and enhance this work. How we feel this is largely dependent on how well we understand these risks and how well we manage them. Next slide, please. The work to do that you've already heard here today in this hearing is that we need to think about how we balance the climate equation. How we end up feeling and experiencing these extremes will depend on how well we prevent further warming. This is what we often call mitigation. And how will we prepare for the changes we've set in motion? This is much of what I discussed today. We can see that if we balance this equation and think about how to do these both, we can actually think about saving money, that there's a return on investment. The National Institute of Building Sciences in 2019 put together a report that shows that for every dollar invested in natural hazard mitigation, of course, these are not all climate-driven events, but natural hazards, governments can save between $6 and $12. Mitigation and adaptation benefits, of course, can happen together. We call these co-benefits. Investments in things like green infrastructure and updated building standards can reduce emissions while also increasing resiliency. There's also evidence that there's a meaningful return on investment on these decisions. So just as the choice is ours in regards to how much warmer the planet gets through our emissions, the choice is ours for how well prepared we will be. Of course, managing for climate risks is another challenge and priority amongst what I understand is a long list of other urgent and competing priorities. However, with climate change, we cannot wait. The time is now and the costs are here. We can embrace this challenge and use it as a force to multi-solve for the other issues our state and our society are facing. There are pathways to this climate-informed decision-making, but it requires a shift in our stance and our position. Embracing a proactive climate approach is a way to realize this opportunity. And with that, I'm going to pass it to Dr. Hellman, who will outline concrete examples of actions and opportunities and ways we might work to shift into a proactive stance. Dr. Hellman, I'll pass it to you.
Thank you, Dr. Roop. Dr. Hellman.
Chair Long, Chair Lee, and committee members. So it's my job to take off where Dr. Roop has led us. She explained that our climate is changing and described some of the important consequences for sectors and assets across our state. And while dealing with those consequences comes with costs, we do have some power over how we confront the challenge of increased climate events. So let's now turn to what we might do and specifically how we might change our approach to capital planning to become climate smart.
Dr. Hellman, before you proceed, please state your name for the record, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Lee. My name is Jessica Hellman. I am a professor at the University of Minnesota and the director of the Institute on the Environment. So when climate change experts in all kinds of fields, from engineering to social science to natural resources and even international relations, they're all talking about this idea of resilience. And resilience is a strategy for confronting climate risk. It's a quality of a system that makes that system flexible so that it can withstand stressors like climate extremes and bounce back. Resilience can apply to any system, such as the ability of a forest to rebound after fire or the ability of a neighborhood to withstand a heat wave or an extended power outage. And we can apply the concept of resilience to buildings and other capital projects that we build, create, or invest in. If we want to increase resilience in our physical assets, we need to move from this more reactive to proactive stance. Of course, we will have no choice but to react to damages that occur from climate extremes. We know that increased extremes are coming, some are already here, and we can never know exactly when or where they will happen. But when they do happen, we'll have to decide what to do about it. Fortunately, we can anticipate that change will occur and plan accordingly. When we take this proactive stance, new design options, new management strategies, and new opportunities arise. And let me explain a bit about what I mean. Let's use Duluth as an initial example. In 2017 and 2018, strong storms off Lake Superior caused $30 million of damage to the city's lake walk, seawalls, and beaches. And of course, Duluth is no stranger to big storms, but these large impact events are an example of the climate impacts we expect to see more of across the state. And we have no choice but to react to the damage the storms caused. The infrastructure will need to be rebuilt or restored. In fact, it's already being rebuilt in a bigger way that the city hopes will withstand future storms. And these are costs we weren't expecting to incur. Rebuilding comes at the cost of other projects and expenditures that Duluth and our state might like to pursue. And as you all know, $13.5 million of state bonding money was directed to the lake walk and seawall repair last year. And as climate shifts, we'll expect to see more examples like this in Duluth, and we'll need a plan for reacting to those damages. Ideally, however, we don't want to be in a reactive position, waiting for damages to happen and spending money to fix them. So let me share a case of more proactive capital investment. This example comes out of state, from Seattle, Washington, but the issue in this example is highly relevant here. And this is a stormwater example, a public asset that is particularly susceptible to increased rainfall. Many cities across the U.S. send sewage into waterways when there's a heavy storm because they rely on a combined sewer and stormwater system. So when heavy rains come, the sewage mixes with the rainwater. It overwhelms the water treatment plant and has to be dumped directly into rivers, lakes, and other waterways. So to address this problem, many municipalities are working to separate their storm and sewer water or storing that combined water during a storm event for later processing. So in Seattle, they're working on precisely this, upgrading some underground piping to reduce combined stormwater overflow. But they realized that already the frequency of overflow events was increasing because the number of big rainfall events was increasing. And climate projections were pointing to even more large storm events in the future. So the city revised its pipe size, increasing the design from tunnels that were 14 feet in diameter to 18 feet in diameter. The project will be operational in 2025 and will prevent an average of 95 million gallons of stormwater and sewage from entering Seattle's waterways each year. And the larger diameter design will increase tunnel storage volume from 15 to 29 million gallons. This example is proactive because it was an anticipated capital project, and the design specs were revised to account for future precipitation extremes. Now, several cities in Minnesota are thinking proactively about stormwater too. According to the Star Tribune, Rochester has their public works department has set up a special unit to tackle heavier stormwater loads. The city of Hutchinson is issuing a 15-year bond to pay for a major stormwater upgrade that accounts for rainfall extremes. And St. Cloud added a new underground tank and tunnel system to hold and treat stormwater in an area prone to flooding. And these upgrades are not inexpensive. An 18-foot pipe is more expensive than a 14-foot pipe. But these are basic costs that were going to be incurred anyway in the Seattle case. And the additional expense paid now will avoid future costs and environmental and infrastructure damages. So let me share with you another proactive example, this one from Missouri. This is an example from Joplin, Missouri, a town that you might recognize. It's in the southwest part of the state, and it was hit with extreme tornadoes in 2011. And this is an example of a restoration project. It was the construction of a replacement hospital that was damaged by the tornado. But the new hospital has design specs that make it storm hardened so that it can withstand strong winds that are expected to be more frequent in the future. It has a precast concrete shell, windows that can withstand high winds, and partially buried generators for backup power in an emergency. It is possible to anticipate climate-related hazards, how they will affect an asset like a hospital, and how they will affect the way that people use that asset before those extreme events occur. Of course, a key question for the bonding committee or anyone responsible for financing and building infrastructure is, how do we do this? How do we shift from a reactive stance, needing to fix something impacted by a climate event, to a more proactive stance that puts more resilient structures in place? There are many possible strategies for approaching climate risk management in the case of capital projects. We've already talked about having to rebuild damaged infrastructure, and we've talked about taking the opportunity when building a planned project or replacing a damaged asset to consider the new asset's resiliency in the face of future climate. There are some other options. We could retreat and not rebuild when a structure is damaged, or locate the asset somewhere else farther out of harm's way. This might apply to roads close to waterways that are experiencing increased flooding, or buildings that find themselves in a flood zone under a changing climate. It's also possible to change the valuation or the expectation for an asset, including how much it might cost to maintain it or how long its useful life might be. An example might be expecting higher energy costs in a building that is going to last into the middle of the century when summer heat is projected to increase. And there are some resiliency strategies that don't rely on building or rebuilding stuff, or at least not rebuilding in entirety. One such strategy relies on better data collection and monitoring techniques, and another leans into nature-based solutions. And let me give you a quick example of each of these. One way to avoid capital expenditures or to reduce them to where they're most needed is investing in sensor technology that supplies data about how a system is operating, where it's failing, and where increased climate stressors are appearing. This is becoming commonplace in storm sewers, where a number of companies have emerged that will install sensors directly into the sewer and connect those sensors to a real-time data management system. And you can use the data to manage the system during an extreme event, directing water flows one way or another during a storm, for example. It also can help locate pain points within the system when it does fail, and can be, and those pain points can be the target for more localized improvements. And this is a diagram of storm sewers in Memphis where this particular technology, storm sensor, is being used. Staying on the stormwater theme and moving to a different location, Washington, D.C. has been grappling with stormwater overflows and is also enhancing its sewer system with new pipes and tunnels. And like Seattle, that infrastructure is expected to come online in 2025. The impact of that new piping on gallons overflowing is shown on the left-hand side of this graph at two locations within the city over time. And you can see when the project starts being operational. But starting in 2017, DC began installing a variety of nature-based solutions and green infrastructure, such as rain gardens, green roofs, and permeable pavement, to get water into the soil where it can be temporarily stored before making its way to the storm system. And as a result of green infrastructure improvements, DC is already reducing the number of gallons per year of combined sewer overflow. And that work, that green infrastructure, will operate in parallel with the big capital project, as shown on the right side of this graph. Of course, there are consequences of not taking climate into consideration when doing capital or investment planning. First and foremost, the lost or damaged assets diminish public services and remove or reduce something that was meeting a public need. Also, if we miss the chance to think proactively about the climate when we're confronting a new project, we also risk expensive replacements and upgrades, or higher maintenance or insurance costs to sustain the project during its lifetime. And there's a new risk on the horizon that I want to particularly point out, having to do with the ability to finance capital projects. Agencies that produce bond ratings are beginning to evaluate the steps that governments are taking or not taking to address climate risks in their capital projects. In 2017, for example, the bond rating agency Moody's acquired a climate risk consulting company with the goal of including climate when evaluating creditworthiness. According to a Moody's report, the effects of climate change will be, quote, a growing negative credit factor for issuers without sufficient adaptation and mitigation strategies, end quote. A couple of other considerations when thinking about how to position our state in capital planning and financing with respect to climate change. The first is that there appears to be a rapidly evolving federal landscape of funding, including an announcement just a couple of days ago that was reported in the New York Times, that $3.7 billion could become available in the Building Resilient Infrastructure and Communities program that awards grants to preemptively protect against damage through construction projects, relocation, or other resiliency steps. It's also important to consider not only the direct effects of a changing climate and climate extremes, how much it's going to rain, for example, but there are also indirect effects of a changing climate, such as how it affects settlement patterns, patterns of economic development, or economic competitiveness. And while Dr. Roop and I have talked about real and serious climate risks here in Minnesota, there are some changes, such as spring and summer drought and duration of summer heat. Spring and summer drought on the left, these are projections into the future from the National Climate Assessment, and the duration of summer heat on the right. These are two things that our state will experience less of than other parts of the U.S. Another case is sea level rise. And this could even lead to subtle demographic and economic shifts toward the Great Lakes region. And those shifts could be a larger issue for public infrastructure than, say, individual rainfall events. It's very hard to predict those kinds of demographic changes, but it is already standard to include demographic projections in capital planning. And those models are starting also to take climate change into consideration. So we're reaching the end. We have a set of recommendations. We put together, Dr. Roop and I, this sort of survey of documented changes, projected changes, resiliency strategies, and other considerations. And then we put our heads together and said, what are some recommendations we might leave with all of you? Things that you might think about as you steer bonding in major state investments going forward. First, we want to emphasize that dealing with climate risk and seeking climate resilient solutions to that risk is the new normal. This will require new monitoring, new concepts of what is the baseline, to Dr. Roop's analogy of looking in the rearview mirror versus looking forward. The rearview mirror doesn't give us as useful of a baseline anymore. And also the need for some new strategies, as I discussed. Given that, we think it's wise to formally consider the future climate when doing infrastructure and capital planning. This could be done with formal climate projections, or even just using scenarios, thinking about what are the possibilities that the future could bring. Putting these processes in place will be important to guard against changes in bond rating. Third, we would increase resilient design standards, including allowing flexibility in what those standards might be, because there are different climatic effects in different locations, and the local context could be important. Also thinking about how to make both projects and the planning process adaptive so that adjustments can be made before and after the project is in place to account for changing climatic conditions. And also promoting the consideration of future climate in addition to considering historic climate within the professions that design, build, and operate capital projects. I have a few more. We also realize that you all must make the best use of limited resources. There's only so much money in the budget and so much debt that can be taken on. We suggest including climate in that priority setting process, looking to solutions for public needs that don't have to be physical structures, such as including nature-based solutions or reduce the need for physical structures, and thinking about how to position the state for federal grants and programs. Some other states and regions are even looking for new ways to raise funds, such as creating new infrastructure banks that leverage public funds to attract private financing. In fact, Dr. Roop and I have made reference in our presentation to other states for several examples. And though we are sometimes remiss to do that kind of thing here in Minnesota, because we have wonderful ideas here, there is a lot of experimenting and learning by doing that is going on across the U.S. right now. And we can most certainly benefit from others' experiences. And with that, thank you, Chair Lee and Chair Long and all members of the Capital Investment and the Capital and the Climate and Energy Finance and Policy Committees for the opportunity to share these thoughts with you today. And we look forward to the opportunity to answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Hellman. We will next be hearing from Frank Kolash. Mr. Kolash, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Great. Thank you, Chair Long. Thank you, Chair Lee, for the opportunity to speak to the joint committees, and thank you all the representatives for allowing me to speak for the record. My name is Frank Kolash. I'm Climate Director for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I will be sharing my screen briefly and giving you a presentation on the greenhouse gas emissions report that we issued on January 14th. So to begin, as you heard from Dr. Knuth at the beginning, the overall picture is not positive. We are heading in the wrong direction. So what we are seeing is that on this chart, our statewide emissions compared to the Next Generation Energy Act goal, which was established in a bipartisan manner in 2007. And what we are seeing in 2017 and 2018, our emissions actually went up, which means we only have an 8% reduction from 2005 levels. The Next Generation Energy Act set goals for the state for statewide emissions as a 15% reduction by 2015, which we did not meet, a 30% reduction by 2025, which we are not on track to meet, and also an 80% reduction by 2050, which we're not on track to meet. And then considering that the science that has been developed since the Next Generation Energy Act was adopted also identifies that the 80% goal by 2050 may not be adequate to avoid the significant impacts of climate change and the largest temperature increases that you heard with the previous presentation. So looking a little bit more specifically at where are these emissions coming from within Minnesota, this chart shows the breakdown by the major sectors that we look at, transportation being the largest greenhouse gas emission sector in the state. And then at the bottom, we're seeing the actual millions of tons that have been reduced or increased within each sector, and then the percent reduction. And you'll see that the transportation sector has had a moderate reduction in emissions since 2005. The electric generation sector, as again you heard previously, has seen the largest reduction and is on track to meet the 2025 goal. Agriculture and forestry and land use is a challenging picture. I'll talk a little bit more about that one in the future, but it's had a very moderate reduction, and that variation is significantly impacted by the amount of carbon that we are calculating stored within our landscapes and especially our forests. And then we see the smaller sectors, which again, I'll talk to you more specifically about these, but within the industrial, residential, and commercial sectors, actually seeing increases due to the use of natural gas and fossil fuels. So looking at the transportation sector, this is the largest source of emissions in the state, and it is in need of the most swift action. Most of the reductions that we've seen since 2005 came because of federal changes due to increasing the fuel economy standards and more stringent tailpipe emission standards at the federal level, but those have recently been weakened. And so we don't anticipate that we will see the same benefits from those federal actions. And also within this sector, we're seeing that light and medium duty vehicles account for more than half of the emissions in this sector. And those are the vehicles we drive, our passenger cars, our pickup trucks, our SUVs, our minivans, our crossover utility vehicles that we drive on our roads every day using gasoline and diesel. And then if we add into this category our diesel engines, heavy-duty diesel engines, we see that we're looking at 70% of the emissions coming from engines that are burning diesel and gasoline and operating on our roads in the state. So to highlight again, transportation has seen a 7% reduction since 2005, and identifying specifically what we need to address this sector, and again, looking at the major trends within this sector, and that is implement our clean car standards to ensure that we have the cleanest, most efficient vehicles that will achieve greenhouse gas emission reductions and reductions from harmful air pollutants in the state. We also need to invest in cleaner fuels, especially our cleaner and lower carbon biofuels of lower carbon ethanol and lower carbon biodiesel. Those have been shown as necessary fuels to help us get to an 80% or greater greenhouse gas emission reduction by 2050 in this sector. Then also we need to continue to expand Minnesota's EV charging network, and that's being accomplished through the Minnesota's Volkswagen settlement programs and our grants to spend money that is allowed from that settlement for EV charging infrastructure build out. And also in the governor's budget, the Department of Transportation has asked for money to expand EV charging network in Minnesota, and also for the ability to build out EV charging on their lands. And then in the 2020 bonding bill, the Department of Administration received $2 million to build EV in charging infrastructure on state properties, including buildings, parks and rest areas that may also have the ability for the public to use those. Now moving on to electric generation, this is the close second to the transportation sector. These top three account for 70% of our emissions and are really close to each other when we look at them all together. This is the area where the progress so far has been the most most dramatic, and it's been tied to, as you heard from Dr. Knuth, to Minnesota's action with the renewable energy standard, with the electric efficiency standard, and the focus on this area to decarbonize and reduce the emissions from this sector. This, again, is the only sector on track to meet the Next Generation Energy Act goals. So looking at what we need to do to continue the emission reductions is to adopt the 100% clean energy by 2040 standard, the bill that you heard last week, prioritize clean energy first when we are replacing or adding on generation to prioritize the cleanest energy, and then also look for ways to help our households and our businesses and our industrial sector to increase energy efficiency. I think all of those bills in the Climate and Energy Committee you have heard. And while this is sector is on track to meet the emission reduction goals. It also identifies a place where we can leverage emission reductions in other sectors by having the cleanest electric generation and then be able to use that in other sectors for emission reductions. So moving on to the agriculture, forestry, and land use, again, this is a challenging one. Within this one, we see carbon that is stored in our forest. We also see emissions that come from our cropland use. And we also have emissions that come from our animal agricultural uses. And so they vary significantly, mostly because of the way that we're calculating the amount of carbon stored in the forests going each year to year. And then with nitrous oxide and methane, this is the major sector for those two greenhouse gases, and those are more potent greenhouse gases than carbon dioxide. So seeking emission reductions in this area can add additional potency to our ability to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions and also be able to store carbon in this sector. And that's really important because we have significant opportunity to store carbon in our forests, our urban forests, and our prairies and our croplands in Minnesota going forward. So again, looking at this overall, it's been a modest reduction, primarily due to the storage of carbon on our forests in Minnesota. And so within the budget, this is an area that the governor's budget developed through the climate change subcabinet has a particular significant focus on. So we want to help farmers implement proven climate smart practices. We want to improve farmland soil health by accelerating cover crop usage. We want to protect Minnesota's landscape after major precipitation events. And then we also want to increase tree cover in Minnesota and the additional needs with that sector. And now looking at those other smaller sources of emissions, but when added up, they actually become a significant source of emissions. And these are what I'm categorizing the buildings. So this is our industrial sector, our residential sector, and our commercial sector, because when we look at the emissions within these sectors, they're primarily coming from the burning of a fossil fuel to heat the building for the space heating. Within the industrial sector, there can also be some burning of fossil fuels to support the manufacturing, the industrial processes, but we're seeing significant amount of that also being used for the building heating and the space heating. And I just want to make note that within these sectors, we are not looking at the emissions that come from the electricity use in these buildings, because those are captured in the electric generation sector. So to highlight the factors that we're looking at here and the need to act, is you'll see here just the significant signal that we're seeing from the use of natural gas in all of these sectors, including those for heating their buildings. And this is a primary area where we need to focus on, because while they have been smaller, they are the ones that are growing within the state. And we need to be able to focus on reducing these emissions while and leveraging what we are seeing with the other sectors, especially the electric generation sector. So looking at these three sectors together, in aggregate, they've increased emissions by 21%. And in order to address these, we really need to look at forwarding and adopting the carbon reduction goals for existing buildings. That was part of the governor's clean energy plan that was announced recently. And then also, we want to focus on developing more energy efficient commercial and large multifamily buildings through the use of building standards and the work that the Department of Labor and Industry is looking at for this sector. Much of the work that you heard on what we need to be doing and what we're focusing on is coming out of the climate change subcabinet, which is coming out of the governor's One Minnesota Climate Vision. And what we want to focus on is that within the climate change subcabinet, that's made up of 15 of the agencies within the cabinet that are most directly related to addressing greenhouse gas emissions, but also building and achieving greater resiliency and preparing for the changing climate that we have from our past emissions. And so our shared climate vision is to meet or exceed our greenhouse gas emission reduction goals and achieve 100% clean energy by 2050, which that has actually been moved up with the recent announcement to 2040. Enhance the climate resiliency of Minnesota's natural resources, working lands and communities. Assist state enterprises, families and businesses and local communities to prepare for climate impacts that cannot be avoided. Promote economic development, innovation and job creation. And then also ensure that there is an equitable distribution of the benefits and address disparities in current impacts that are related to climate change and past socioeconomic conditions and environmental exposures. So we also want to highlight that within the governor's budget that we also are focusing on resiliency. We have a significant focus on reducing emissions, but we also do have proposals that will provide assistance to cities and counties, local units of government, our tribal governments, our tribal partners, to identify the needs and opportunities for building resiliency and adapting to a changing climate. And then finally, the executive order calls for us to expand our engagements with all Minnesotans to identify the ways to create policies and strategies that will reduce our emissions and address the existential crisis presented by climate change, and also build into the resiliency and adaptation of our communities and our natural resources. And to do this, we're leveraging the work of multiple efforts, which includes the Climate Change Subcabinet, the Governor's Advisory Council on Climate Change, looking at the recommendations of the Governor's Council on biofuels that will help reduce greenhouse gas emissions, looking at the recommendations provided by Department of Transportation, Sustainable Transportation Advisory Council, and then working with the Minnesota Climate Adaptation Partnerships and all kinds of partnerships and all other interested parties that want to see us reduce emissions and build resiliency in Minnesota. And with that, I will end my presentation and allow you to move on to your next speaker.
Thank you so much, Mr. Kolash. We have two remaining speakers and then we'll move to questions. And next up is Mr. Rockwell. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you very much, Chair Lee and Long, members of the committees. My name is Sam Rockwell. I am executive director of Move Minnesota and also teach a course at the University of Minnesota on transportation law, policy, and design. I'll be filling in a little bit more information on the transportation sector here, building off of some of the things we've heard from Drs. Knuth, Root, and Mr. Kolash. So to review, Dr. Knuth indicated the extraordinary urgency under the IPCC guidelines, as did Dr. Root, and it's worth pausing and reflecting on how quickly we must act, right? This particular session this year is critical for action, because the longer we wait, the more extraordinary the cuts we need to make in any given year. And of course, this plays out in our transportation sector, which Mr. Kolash just noted is our highest emitting sector here in Minnesota, and that cars and light trucks are the greatest percentage of that transportation emissions, of those emissions. Electric vehicles are critical. I will leave the descriptions of our needed investments in that sector to Mr. Kolash's presentation. It's also important to understand that we are not going to get our needed emissions with electric vehicles alone. And I'll fill in the details on this in my proposal, in my presentation here. We have great news that General Motors is shifting to an all-electric fleet by 2035, and we are seeing increased electric vehicle production happen. But the levels of production are not going to speed up fast enough to hit a 2050 target, and that is in part because in order to have zero emissions from our automobiles, every single car sold by 2030 would have to be an electric vehicle. Every single car, because the cars that are on the road have long lifespans. Cars are built well, the average lifespan is 20 to 22 years. And so in order to achieve carbon targets, we need to be reducing how much we are driving. We need to be shifting to some of those lower emissions, higher efficiency modes, like biking, walking, and in particular, because of its ability to transport high capacity people transit. Right now, we're doing the opposite. We are increasing VMT, which is vehicle miles traveled, year after year. This is in part because our land use is facilitating this, and it's in part because we have invested capital investments in the past in the ability to drive above the ability to take transit, to bike, or to walk. Minnesota is actually the fifth highest road miles of any state in the United States, although it comes in just 14th in terms of land area and 22nd in terms of population. So we have overinvested in our road miles in the state of Minnesota. And that then determines how much we drive. There's a phenomenon in urban planning and civil engineering called induced demand, which is that the more capacity you have, the more folks drive. How this works is people start, the more capacity allows a more spread out land uses instead of compact cities, towns, suburbs with a clear center. And so the destinations are not all concentrated in a single area, but are spread out. It also gives folks the opportunity, or gives folks the impression that they don't need to accomplish multiple things in one trip. They might go to the grocery store, then back home, then take the child to school, then back home, then to the hardware store, then back home. Whereas when our land use is more concentrated, which is necessary under different transportation infrastructure systems, and when there's less capacity on the road, folks actually drive fewer miles. So there's a direct link between how many road miles we have and how we make those investments and what our emissions are, because our emissions and our miles driven are so linked. We know we must act really quickly on reducing vehicle miles traveled, and we know what we need to do. The Minnesota House Climate Action Plan, which was referenced earlier, notes the need to reduce driving by investing in alternatives. We can't reduce driving rates without investing in alternatives. So capital investments are critical. The MnDOT Sustainable Transportation Advisory Committee, just referenced in the last presentation, recommended to the commissioner a statewide goal to reduce VMT, vehicle miles traveled, the amount we drive by 20% by 2050. Now, these goals of reducing driving and this sense of scale are reflected in research across the country, both academic research and research done by peer state governments and research done by some of the cities in the state of Minnesota. A 20% reduction in driving across the state of Minnesota does not mean that every individual reduces driving by 20%. Instead, it needs to be concentrated in areas where those alternatives to driving are possible, where we can have a transit system that actually serves people in a logical way, where biking and walking is safe and possible. And so we see the targets identified at Minneapolis and St. Paul, for example, are between 40 and 50% driving reductions by 2050, which then allows for significantly lower reductions, or potentially no reductions at all, in some parts of Minnesota where it's just not possible to reduce how much we drive in any kind of practical way. The benefits of investing in transit, biking, and walking is that we also build an economy that is significantly more resilient. These maps are from the Center for Transportation Studies at the University of Minnesota. And what you're looking at is on the left, a map showing that folks who are have access to an automobile can access about 1 to 5 million jobs in 30 minutes. That's the red and deep purple areas. Whereas folks who rely on transit can access about 100 to 250,000 jobs in 30 minutes. So that means the amount of economic opportunity and activity that we are facilitating by these different modes is extraordinarily disjointed. And we are forcing folks into spending money on automobiles and on gas and car payments and insurance where they could be spending that money here at home. So
Rockwell,
these are big changes, right?
Ask if you could wrap up.
What's that?
I'll just ask if you could wrap up since we leave time for questions.
Yes. These are big changes. These are popular changes across the state of Minnesota. We've seen that in the MnDOT and local polling, and it's also the kind of changes that can happen in every type of community. Every kind of community, whether Tower, Minnesota, population 420, or Minneapolis, 420,000, can facilitate biking, walking, and transit. And that ends my presentation.
Thank you so much, Mr. Rockwell. And our final speaker is Mr. Passer. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Great. Good morning, Chair Lee, Chair Long, and members. My name is Ben Passer, and I'm the lead director of Energy Access and Equity at Fresh Energy. Hopefully you all can see my slides on the screen here, and I will be ticking through those quickly. I've got about 6 or 7 minutes of presentation, and I know we want to leave time for questions at the end. So thank you all for allowing this great panel here this morning. I appreciate the opportunity to join you all this morning to discuss opportunities to support Minnesota's public policy goals through safe, efficient, and affordable housing for all Minnesotans. Just to provide brief background on Fresh Energy, we're an independent energy policy nonprofit, and for 28 years, we've been working at the state legislature and in other venues to advance clean energy in Minnesota. Our Energy Access and Equity Program, which I lead, focuses on ensuring a just and equitable energy transition for all Minnesotans, including under-resourced communities, renters, communities of color, and those living throughout Greater Minnesota. A large part of our work around housing and energy is through our leadership of the Minnesota Multifamily Affordable Housing Energy Network. Since 2014, this network has connected the energy and housing sectors in Minnesota to break down silos in communication, address challenges, and identify solutions. Our network includes a diverse range of interests and perspectives, including utilities from across the state, energy and housing advocates, housing owners and developers, service providers, and renters. Through this network, we have been able to find numerous opportunities to expand access to energy efficiency for under-resourced Minnesotans and support stable and affordable housing in our state. Energy efficiency in multifamily buildings and other residential properties is a win-win. Increased energy efficiency is one of the lowest hanging fruits to tackle high energy burdens, which, as I'll talk about in a minute, is a significant problem throughout the state. Roughly 44% of all renters are cost burdened, meaning they spend over 30% of their income on housing costs alone, making high energy bills even harder to afford. Further, a recent study of rental households in the Twin Cities found that under-resourced, also known as low-income, households had roughly double the energy burden of the average household. Energy efficiency also contributes to increased health and comfort, reducing potential medical expenses or costly tenant turnover. And through the long-term savings provided by energy efficiency, utility customers, whether the renter or building owner pays the bill, can not only see direct savings on utility bills, but building owners benefit from lower maintenance costs over the life of the building. In our work, we frequently talk about energy burden, which is the proportion of household income that is spent on energy costs. This map comes from the U.S. Department of Energy's Low Income Energy Affordability Data, or LEED, tool, and shows that high energy burdens, the darker areas on this map, are a significant problem in every part of the state. Digging even deeper, we know that some Minnesotan households are facing even higher energy burdens. The most recent Home Energy Affordability Gap Report, conducted by researcher Roger Colton and his team, found that households below 50% of the federal poverty level, I believe that's roughly $13,000 annual income for a family of four, are paying 33% of their income for energy costs alone. That's striking when you consider that that 33% of household income refers solely to energy costs and doesn't factor in other basic necessities such as food, transportation, healthcare, and childcare and education expenses. Through policy and smart investments, we can ensure that all Minnesotans are benefiting. Our current energy efficiency policy, the Conservation Improvement Program, or CIP, requires minimum spending requirements for utilities serving under-resourced households, but spending still falls short of the actual need, and those programs are not incentivized to provide deeper savings for those households who need it the most. At the same time, communities across the state are facing affordable housing shortages and housing stock that is aging and inefficient. We can do more to ensure that all Minnesotans have safe, efficient, and affordable housing. Last year's bonding bill was a good start in this direction. Signed into law last October, House File 1 allocated funds to housing infrastructure bonds, which can be used for permanent supportive housing, affordable senior housing, and preservation of federally subsidized rental housing, and the state's housing development fund to rehabilitate and preserve public housing. Notably, the housing redevelopment funds allow priority for proposals that leverage other non-state resources to maximize health, safety, and energy investments. our policies can continue in this direction and ensure that that under-resourced communities throughout Minnesota benefit. House File 164, which has been introduced this session, would expand energy efficiency programs serving under-resourced households and strengthen our state's nation-leading energy efficiency standards. Through tools like the Renewable Development Account, we can ensure that under-resourced communities can benefit from clean energy investments like energy efficiency and renewable energy. As the most recent bonding bill showed, we can also use a broader package of infrastructure investments to leverage other funding streams and make our state dollars go even further. We can look to innovative models like the 4D tax incentive program launched in Minneapolis, where in exchange for long-term affordability agreements, rental property owners receive reduced tax liability and are connected to energy efficiency resources. And Shirley, I think I may have heard you jump in.
Yep. Can you wrap up your presentation so that we can move on to a member's question? We have at least 10 members now.
Absolutely. I'd be happy to, Chair Lee. I wanted to close with a couple of examples of recent legislation in other states. I believe members have this information in your handout, so I won't take through all of these specifically. These are just some transformative examples of energy and housing legislation in other states, but I believe with strong policy and a suite of infrastructure investments that deliver multiple benefits for all Minnesotans, we can continue to lead. And thank you for your time, and with that, I will close my presentation.
So thank you, Mr. Passer, and I just want to say thank you to all the presenters for coming in to talk about what can we do to invest in infrastructure that will lead to a more sustainable and climate resilient Minnesota. And so members, since we have about 10 members hands up, I will allocate about a minute to a minute and a half for you to ask your one question and for the presenter to answer that, and then we'll move on to the next member. And so the first question that I have for Dr. Hellman, you mentioned the FEMA Building Resilient Infrastructure Program. Can you just talk a little bit about that, please? Dr. Hellman?
Yes, Chair Lee, thank you for that question. Committee members, I admit that I was recently looking into this opportunity myself. It seems that the Biden administration is interested in allocating some more proactive funding for climate resiliency into the FEMA, into FEMA administration. But I would need to look into that more carefully and get back to you and learn more about what these recent announcements actually mean. I think it's a process in flux at the moment, in fact.
Thank you, Dr. Hellman. So next up, we have Representative Monson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for the presenters today, thanks for offering a really detailed presentation. I noticed in Mr. Rockwell's presentation that when he was displaying the amount of carbon emitted from different transportation sources, that the 100% electric vehicle actually had a larger carbon footprint than gasoline hybrid vehicles, because he was actually looking at the entire supply chain, looking at the production going into manufacturing. And so my question is either to Mr. Kolosh from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency or to Dr. Roop from the Minnesota University of Minnesota Soil and Water. In your studies for the green energy, do you look at the really disastrous impact that we're having in our energy policies on third world countries to see the pollution that's from all the chemicals that they're using and the mining that they're doing under substandard environmental conditions?
Dr. Roop, do you want to take this one?
Sure. Thank you, Chair Lee, and thank you for Representative Munson for that question. I actually do not have research expertise in the fields that you're inquiring about, but I'd be more certainly happy to connect you to those relevant expertise. Most of my work is in climate information and adaptation, not specifically in energy and pollutants and contaminant transportation.
Okay, and Mr. Kolosh, are you able to answer this question too, or no?
Chair Lee, I can add some additional information to this, that when we look at the emissions that come from electric vehicles, we do include a what we call the well-to-wheel type of analysis for both gasoline, for diesel, and for the electric generation. And we usually make our assumptions based on what is the current Minnesota average electricity mix, so that we are incorporating all of the sources of electricity, and we still will show that the emissions from electric vehicles, even with the average Minnesota electricity mix, are less than those of gasoline engines, and that that improvement is even larger when electric vehicles are charged with renewable energy through some sort of a green tariff or renewable choice charging station. So that's what we look at. And in regarding to the mining and the batteries, we're looking into to that, and we understand that there are within the U.S. Department of Energy and the European Union and the industry groups are all looking into that about making sure that they're meeting their environment and sustainability goals and addressing the sustainability of some of the mining that goes into the metals for the battery manufacturer. And that continues to work, and we want to focus on increasing and improving that area as well, and also understanding that the risk from climate change also will fall disproportionately upon those types of communities and countries that will have lower resources to adapt to a changing climate that they're going to see on their scale. So we're trying to make sure that we're keeping that in focus in both areas.
Thank you, Mr. Kalash. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Chairman Lee and Chairman Long, and all the presenters. I appreciated the information and the insights. My question is partly comment is that through the bonding tools that we have the opportunity to take on three major crises that we're facing of climate, of equity, and of the need for economic recovery. And I am concerned about the risk of analysis paralysis. I am a practical, let's do things kind of person. And so I'm wondering what you've seen in other locations about best practices for helping us focus, cut through all of the many options which have been presented today. There's so much more opportunity than money to be able to make good choices that will benefit us across our communities and to achieve those ultimate goals.
Dr. Hellman.
Chairman Lee, Chairman Long, Representative Ryer. That's a terrific question. I will answer with one particular thought on the paralysis, and that really is, I think, the importance of taking the opportunity when projects emerge and you know that they are a priority, and taking that moment to incorporate equity concerns, as you say, and also sort of future-proofing and climate-smarting those projects. I see that as the greatest missed opportunity, that when you have a capital project in front of you and you know it can be potentially impacted by future climate extremes, that you wouldn't take that opportunity to make that resilience. So of our list of recommendations, I would put that consideration quite high in your action-oriented framing.
Representative Acorn.
Thank you, Chair Lee and Chair Long, for the hearing and all of our presenters. Was very eye-opening and a little bit sobering too. I want to target my question for Dr. Roop and Dr. Hellman. And you brought up how important it will be for us to look proactively at the issue of climate change and our infrastructure. And you also gave some figures from last year that I've heard on the news as well about the $95 billion in investments last year to climate-related natural disasters. And so I think that sometimes when we hear about these national statistics, we can often not associate it necessarily to what's happening here at home. And so I'm wondering, is there data or are there numbers that look at Minnesota-specific investments, and I know you talked about the event at Duluth and others, and just wondering if there are tools or if we're looking at that data so that we can make sure that we're making that economic argument here.
Who want to take this, Dr. Hellman or Dr. Roop? All right, Dr. Hellman.
Well, I was about to say Dr. Roop is knowledgeable, but I'll add my two cents, Chair Lee, Representative Akam. That's a great question. Some of the data that we referenced specifically come from the National Climate Assessment, which focus on the Midwestern region. That's the data set and the report, the most recent report with which I'm most familiar and tend to reference. I'd have to follow up specifically to see if there are cost estimates off the top of my head for the state of Minnesota. I don't know. Perhaps Dr. Roop does.
Dr. Roop, do you have something quick to add?
Thank you, Chair Lee, and thank you, Chair, Representative Acomb. I don't have specific numbers myself from Minnesota, and so my answer would be the same as Dr. Hellman's, which is that we have a robust amount of information available to us, and much of what we presented today is, in fact, for the Midwest region. But I will point out, of course, we are a connected system, and so these billion-dollar disasters may be occurring in our near backyard in places like Iowa. The derecho was, for example, one of the billion-dollar disasters we experienced in 2020. But those costs come to bear on all of us in the nation. So this is true for climate changes that are occurring outside of our own backyard. And so in that way, we are a connected system, but I appreciate the need for those place-specific Minnesota numbers.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry to jump in here, but I have actually, and I really, Is it okay if I answer?
Go ahead, Dr. Knuth. Please keep it short.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Acomb for the question, because I think it's spot on. And I have been looking for these numbers for months, probably at least a year, and have not been able to find Minnesota-specific data on the costs of climate impacts and climate disasters on our infrastructure, on our public infrastructure. There's just not an overall understanding for our state, as far as I have been able to find, and I've been looking quite closely for quite some time. I will say on that $95 billion statistic, I think it was about $40 billion of that were convective storms. So we often in Minnesota will be like, oh, it's sea level rise, or it's hurricanes, or it's that stuff that doesn't affect us. But convective storms are things like derechos and thunderstorms and hail, which we obviously know as derechos being those like really big straight line winds. Those are things that we experience here, and so you in that data there are a significant chunk of it is potentially impacting our state.
Thank you, Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Chair Lee and Chair Long, and to all the presenters. Thank you very much for this discussion this morning. I'm a little bit embarrassed. There's so much overlap to the committee that I happen to chair, the Legacy Committee, to the work that we do, and so I may have to invite you to our committee as well, or certainly have our group watch us. There's much work's going on now around the state. You know, that example that was brought up of the boardwalk in Duluth just being washed out was just a powerful thing. So as we do investments with the legacy money, for example, or in capital investment, or, you know, many of these, you know, all the committees, you know, we need to take that in mind, that what we might do is washed out, or if we're restoring a prairie, or you know, that the edge of a stream isn't washed out, you know, these heavy rains. But anyways, thank you for this presentation. I don't really have a question at this point, but very much support this. On a personal note, I just want to throw out there, Dr. Knuth, I'm sorry about your loss with your father. He's a great guy, and definitely led on so many things, but certainly a leader in parks and trails for the state of Minnesota. But sorry about your loss.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. Next up, we have Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for Dr. Hellman or Dr. Roop, so I'm in Northfield. We have a lot of trouble with flooding of the Cannon River in the downtown, and we need to find a way to hold water back on the landscape. I'm wondering if you have thoughts on that, things we could be doing in Minnesota, ways to be thinking about that in terms of infrastructure as well.
Dr. Roop?
Thank you, Chair Lee and Chair Long, and thank you for that question, Representative Lippert. There are new reports available specifically thinking about how we can look at investments like green infrastructure and how we can actually use our landscape as one part of the way in which we build solutions to some of these issues that you're describing in your own community. So I encourage you to think about how it is you can use land surrounding your rivers or your sort of whole watershed as part of your solution to this problem. I think typically when we look at a problem, we sort of look at the immediate surroundings, again, rather than thinking about it as part of a system or a comprehensive whole. And there's lots of opportunity in sort of broadening our scope and thinking about what's happening upstream and downstream and where there's opportunity to, say, store water on the landscape. I know Minnesota, the state of Minnesota is investing in and exploring opportunities for, say, using farmland as a way to hold back water as we get it. And so I am excited to see an investment in these solutions, as well as lots of evidence and reports that we just recently have produced specifically for Minnesota about these very specific opportunities that you might be able to incorporate in your own community. And I'd be happy to supply those to your office.
Representative Ajay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairs, and thank you to the presenters. One thing stood out to me in the presentation, particularly when it comes to urban landscapes. So one thing I was interested in about, you know, building more resilient infrastructure in those areas, especially as it relates to carbon sequestration. Any of you can answer this that knows, but what have been some of the results that you've seen in other locations in rebuilding urban canopies, especially to address the heat islands and other health risks that come up in urban areas?
Dr. Helman or Dr. Rupp?
Chairman Lee, Representative Agbaje, that's a terrific question. We talk frequently about the co-benefits of these different green infrastructure strategies. And when we think about urban tree cover, it does tend to invite analysis or focus on urban heat island. And we did a study, for example, several years ago in the city of Chicago, where we actually looked at green roofs as a green infrastructure strategy for reducing urban heat. What we found in that study, and it, to complement trees at the surface level, but green roofs were able to reduce heat during the hottest days by a small but meaningful amount. And it's actually the hottest days that we need to be most cognizant of with respect to public health concerns, air quality concerns, and some of these equity concerns where there are differences in the amount of green infrastructure in different neighborhoods. So I think that focusing on the particularly hot days and strategies of that urban planning and utilization of green infrastructure is especially important. And there are also indirect effects which are meaningful to consider too. For example, in that study, we showed not only did you reduce the maximum daytime temperature by a few degrees, which has meaningful impacts on public health, but it also substantially reduced energy demand of the building for cooling itself in that heat scenario. So it has an economic component too.
So Representative Franson, and then Representative Sosinski, and then Representative Long to close. Representative Franson.
Can you hear me? All right, thank you. So I'm just taking this all in, of course, and I'm just wondering, members, there are some serious concerns, as Representative Munson has brought out regarding the human rights. So I'm wondering how many children you are willing to sacrifice for clean energy. There's child labor issues for cobalt in the Congo, slave labor in China with solar panels. Why are we, the United States of America, the land of the free, using children and slavery in order to obtain a utopia here in our country? China is not playing by the same green energy rules, those climate change goals. In fact, there's an article in Reuters on January 24, 2020. China has 250 gigawatt of coal-fired power under development, or GW of coal-fired power under development study. They're looking at expanding coal. We here are shutting down our coal power capacity, leading people in northern Minnesota, all around our state, to freeze in the wintertime. This is really concerning. Is China, who's continuing to build coal power plants, is that an existential crisis to the world, to this country? Is child labor another threat? Slavery a threat? This is what we really have to think about. Yes, you may want green energy, you may want carbon-free energy by 2050, which of course Kerry has said is probably not realistic. These are things that we really need to think about. Green energy is not clean energy. It is dirty energy. Just take a look at how mining for...
We have to move on to Representative Sosinski and then Representative Long. Representative Sosinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, sounds good. My question was to the last presenter. I believe it was Ben. Yes.
Go ahead.
It was Ben?
Yep.
Yes. So my question, you know, you talked a little bit about, you know, low-income housing and the cost of energy and its increase. You know, what kind of have you seen and how has been that impact on those families in the last 10 years or 15 years?
Mr. Passer, real quickly to respond to that, and then Representative Long.
Chair Lee and Representative Swedzinski, excuse me, we've seen numerous benefits to under-resourced households throughout the state, really over the last decade or more, through expanded utility energy efficiency programs that are better serving those households. And, you know, frankly, that's been a hard customer segment to reach. Utilities are working harder and harder to better reach those customers, and we appreciate their efforts in that regard. But we've seen, you know, I think, increased energy efficiency, better programs, but unfortunately, due to just overall economic factors, that energy burden remains quite high, as you saw in my slides and in the handout. So I think, you know, on the energy side, we've seen improvements, but we also see lagging economic indicators as well. And so there's more work to be done.
Thank you. Chair Long, closing.
Thank you so much, Chair Lee. Thank you for this outstanding hearing. You know, both our committees have resources we can allocate on infrastructure. And I think the discussion today has been really enlightening about how we can keep in mind both the need to mitigate and adapt to climate change. We know that our state is getting warmer and wetter and has more extreme weather. It makes absolute sense to use this knowledge when we're making spending decisions. And we also know that we can invest in solutions like the Capital Investment Committee did with the electric vehicle infrastructure or having more efficient buildings, and like we've done with our renewable development account in the Energy Committee. So I thank everybody for joining today and thank all of our testifiers for an outstanding hearing.
Thank you all. This meeting is adjourned.